Welcome to the Endurance Town USA Project. This podcast, along with our blogs and adventure team, travel around the world creating and sharing the stories of humans changing lives through endurance sports. Today, we're introducing a new mini-series, Endurance is a State of Mind, featuring the stories of six beautiful humans who use endurance sports and mindset training to live to their potential. We explore their why and gather golden nuggets of inspiration and tactics for how to build your own best body and mind. This is Endurance Town USA.
Bring it back. Hey, good morning, my friend Rick. How are you?
I'm so good. I don't know what to do with myself, Sam.
Yeah, Samantha Pruitt, Endurance Town USA. My brother Rick is in South Africa. We're going to talk today about endurance as a state of mind. And let's just go ahead and dig in, shall we? I want people to understand a little bit about who you are as a person. Since I have been blessed with having you in my life, I want to make sure that the world knows a little bit more about you as well, Ricardo. So tell me, my friend, where are you currently? What town?
I'm in Johannesburg, South Africa. The town is Atlasville, and it is roughly 20 kilometers from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Okay, and did you grow up there?
No. I actually grew up in Berkeley, California, a university town, right in the central parts of Berkeley. Not far from where the Vice President Kamala Harris grew up, interestingly enough, and a beautiful, beautiful town. I'm very happy that I did grow up there. I feel very fortunate to have been exposed to so much in terms of diversity and in terms of different ideas and opinions. A very socially conscious place we call Berkeley, California.
Well, that is for sure. So you were born there. Is that where your family comes from? How did you end up at Berkeley?
My family is from Panama. They're from the Atlantic side of the Isthmus. Cool. Colon, Panama, named after Christopher Columbus. Mom and dad were teenage sweethearts. Moved to California in 1953 to a small house in Oakland, California. Mm. And from there in 1957, they moved to our current home in Berkeley, California.
Do you have siblings?
I have an older brother, much older, 18 years older than I am.
Whoa.
And a sister, 10 years older. My brother has no children, married to my beautiful sister-in-law. They've got no kids, but they bring in lots of kids often. And my sister has three children. Those were the younger siblings that I didn't have, being the baby. So my two nieces and nephew were my younger playthings, if you will.
I love it. So what was it like growing up in Berkeley? What were you into as a child?
Skateboarding,
all
BMX,
the hip stuff,
mountain
all the
biking.
Hip stuff.
Oh yeah, there's a rapid transit that came in about 1976, and that's when they were building the stations in Berkeley and North Berkeley and all around our area where we live. So we used to take our BMX bikes and we would ride where they were doing the construction, and it created amazing berms along the side and for jumps and doing tricks. So that was my childhood. Hide and go seek was au fait as well. We loved to play hide and go seek, especially when girls were involved. Then there was wiffle ball, baseball. We played often, and some very serious football games on asphalt, which was, you think what? BMX is dangerous. Yeah. So on our street on asphalt, we'd have big kids, eh? The neighbors, big brothers would come in and they would play quarterback, receiver, blocker. And I can just remember being a young child getting knocked around on cars and on asphalt and the whole bit. So yeah, it was a daunting thing in those 70s, eh? Where, you know, you've seen the memes on social media, drinking water out of the hoses, riding on the back of bicycles with no helmets. And yeah, I remember those days.
How did you do in school?
I did very well in school, man.
Did you?
I was. I mean, you know, I wasn't a nerd, but, you know, I was, in a lot of ways, I was a teacher's pet. So charming, So charming. If I was a, yeah, well, thank you. If I was a, I take it as a compliment. If I were borderline B plus A minus, you know, I would just, you know, bring another apple to school, right? Wasn't that the truth? Yeah.
Those were the days when that was even a thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I love school. Samantha, I mean, the most important part about, you know, getting the good grades and doing well in extracurricular activities and decently in sports was really about enjoying it. I just, from kindergarten right up through to, you know, 12th grade in high school, I just really loved it. I loved people. I loved my teachers. I loved, you know, I went to an all boys Christian Brothers school in Berkeley called St. Mary's College High School. And I mean, it was just, we were free. We were free to be who we wanted to be. We had lots of support. We could choose languages we wanted to speak and as a subject and so many different sports. Some guys even did fencing. It wasn't even at our school, but at the neighboring Berkeley High School, you could get involved. So we were spoiled for choice. And for that, I think, I love that. I love the diversity of activities we could get involved in. I love the fact that, you know, although there were some smarter and some not so smart, everybody had their own gift and they brought it to the party. So, no, I had a wonderful, wonderful early basic education childhood. And by the time I got to Stanford, which is obviously still the Bay Area, but 45 minutes from the house, that's when the adulthood thing came, right? And, you know, academics for me wasn't, it should have been more of a focus, but was less of a focus. And then I think the socializing came in. So that whole thing of being gregarious and loving people took a real front seat. And I think that's where, you know, I learned really about the power of failure, the power of not being the best, the power of learning how to restrain. And I didn't, looking back, I've learned the power of restraint and even of failure, but I didn't know what was happening. I was really just interested in having a good time when it came to university.
So are you saying you had some challenges and you had to overcome them in college, or did you skate by on your good looks and your charisma? What happened?
It was too much good looks, too much popularity, too much charm. And it took me right
over the head.
My head was too big, you know, and I didn't have enough people with a pen to pop it. So I was riding on the wave of popularity. I was riding on the wave of getting by. And that was obviously through, you know, I graduated at 22 years old, and that took me right up until my 30s, right up until my early 30s, until I think the rude awakening came and I had to connect the dots. As Steve Jobs said, looking back, you know, I didn't know what was ahead of me, but I could look back and say, you know, I need to make some changes. And those changes continue to this day. But awareness started about, I would say, 10 years after graduation. I think that's when the awareness happened. And I had to remember those playful years in basic education, apply that, but then make sure that I used gratitude and appreciation and not taking for granted my talents and my gifts, and certainly not trying to use good looks to get by, but rather doing the good and hard work to be a better person.
And what did you decide was going to be your career path then as a young adult?
It was interesting. So at first, you know, going into Stanford, I thought about being a lawyer, being a politician, because I loved English. I loved language. I love being persuasive. That's what charming is about, right?
You still
do. Yeah. So but these are things that are innate, and you have to recognize who you are. And I knew that I knew it as a young child that I could convince people. I was, as I said, very, very persuasive, could coax people into doing things that perhaps they thought was uncomfortable. And I would convince them that, no, it'll be comfortable. We'll do it together. And to this day, I do that. But the lawyer and politician went away when the seriousness wasn't there in university. Because, you know, a politician wouldn't take even a degree from Stanford. But certainly as a lawyer, which for me would have been the ultimate goal at that age, at 18, 19 years old, you got to be serious. You got to study pre-law. You have to, you know, go into graduate school. And I just wasn't there. I wasn't there. And I have no regret.
Yeah.
But I have taken what I know is my gift, and I've utilized it, not as what was my major. My major was international relations. So that's boded well. I mean, you know, living in a foreign country, I traveled a lot, you know, even at Stanford, I love travel. and loving people means I didn't just love people in Berkeley. I love the world. I love, you know, the opportunity to engage people. Yeah. And it's moved me into a space where I am now, where I love to transform lives. And I love to take people from, you know, what they may think is a zero to hero. And it it comes easy to me. Hey? Conflict resolution comes easy. Vulnerability comes easy. Being assertive as opposed to arrogant, and assertive as opposed to being aggressive. It comes easy to me because I know who I am and I know who I am here.
Mm. Yeah, but in that process of becoming is when you discovered who you were. So what was happening in that period between college and, we'll just call it adulting, you know, when you have to become responsible for your own finances and housing and all the things, family's not there to take care of that forever. What were the things that transpired? Were they relationships that got into your life, you know, that had an influence? Was it experiences that were transformational that helped you really grow and mature?
I think the biggest and most transformative experience I had was my first marriage. It was at the right time in terms of my maturity, in terms of what I thought marriage was, but it was the wrong time. And I felt, you know, looking back that, you know, I was very immature because, I mean, I just assumed that I could slide into it the way I had, you know, lived through my university life and my early years after university. And for me, looking back on that, it had everything to do with getting away with not being accountable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I speak about this today. So living in a patriarchal society, you know, it's very easy for a young man, including myself. And in fact, this is about me. So I was being patriarchal, and mm-hmm. I was being, the shark, the gigolo, the womanizer. And this went right into my marriage. And that's what was disappointing. And when I tried to reconcile my marriage, there wasn't any hope, no matter how honest or open I could be. It came as disingenuous because I had so many years behind me mm-hmm. of a behavior that my first wife knew very, very well. She says, but you know, you're always getting away with murder. You're always sliding by and getting away with things. So it ended up in a breakup. So it ended up in divorce. And
I love how she called you hardest... on it.
Say again.
I love how she called you on it.
Yeah. It's, you know, she was always very, very strong. I mean, she was always a strong woman. I you know, the women that I dated, the woman that I married, strong. I didn't want to be with people who were weak in terms of intimate relationships, men or women. I loved a challenge, and I loved people who made me better, and she was one of them. Yeah. And thankfully, you know, although there was hurt and pain on both sides, and it's not about, I feel like oppression, you can't say, well, who's more oppressed or who hurts more. You know, I may have been the antagonist, but at the end of the day, my pain is the fact that, you know, I lost a good woman, and I have an estranged daughter that we have together that, you know, I still don't have a relationship with. And it came from the deep-seated behavior of patriarchy. And what's interesting is both of them to this day speak about a decolonized mind. Of undoing patriarchy, of, you know, a diverse and inclusive society that is equitable. And wow, I mean, and maybe, I don't know, maybe because of, you know, my behavior, you know, in the early 90s, that was, you know, something that they could both, you know, attribute to their roles. But even if I wasn't, you know, a major part in that, it certainly is a narrative that I have learned from, and that I recognize that the good work that they have been doing. My daughter is now 26 years old, and she's doing, you know, excellent work around motivating and inspiring young people and getting them to live their dreams, especially women. She understands the challenges of victimization as well as perpetrators. And because, you know, of the great work she's doing, I'm happy. I'm happy, and I'm excited about the fact that there is no condemnation in lessons that, you know, we may not have won in terms of our relationship, and there's always hope. There's always the potential for reconciliation. The fact is that, you know, where she is today because of her mother, and it may be in large part because of my mistakes, she's, you know, she's flying high. And that's what's important, especially as we look at the next generation, because this is really no longer about us, Sam, that as we decrease, they must increase. And the world that we're living in now, we need leaders. We don't need followers. We need more people to be accountable, and that she is.
That is correct. That is correct. And you moved forward and you did remarry and you have other children, correct? That you're raising now.
Correct.
How many kids do you have?
Mm-hmm. So 4 children, including my daughter in the States. And I have 2 grandchildren by my wife's first marriage. So the oldest daughter has 2 children. And so I've got 2 grandchildren as well. And I'll tell you what, hey, Nelson Mandela said it best. In life, you cannot lose. You either win or learn. And because of the learnings, because of what I learned before moving to South Africa and continued coming into my new relationship and learning the things that I've learned in South Africa and through my work, it's made me such a better husband, such a better father. And I'm just so excited about the future and the potential of taking all of those things that I learned, the challenges, the chaos, the hecticness. I can remember my first wife saying, you know, let's sit in it. How about that? Although, you know, we were broken apart and you know, for the sake of our daughter, she says, well, we're going to have to sit in it. Mm-hmm. And I can remember sitting in it and being uncomfortable and trying to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. And those are some of the things that I experienced today. So those were the lessons that I take with me today. So with my current relationship and with my children and with other people's children, I feel like a real asset because I have the war scars, and I also have the opportunities to celebrate. And the moments to celebrate have been many and immense, even through the period that we're going through now.
Scars are beautiful.
They very well sweet scars, man.
Yeah. Why did you move back? Why did you move to South Africa? You're not from South Africa. Why did you move there?
No. So initially I came as a model. So I was a fashion
model.
And I was working. I was a fashion model. That's
what
right.
Were you modeling? Just curious. Just got to ask.
So brand that you would know in the States would be, my biggest client was Eddie Bauer.
Oh, check talk you about out, Mr. Brand. Outdoor Life. Whoa!
Is Eddie Bauer going strong in the States? Yeah,
totally.
Mm-hmm. Good.
They might call
how
you
do they
back.
Compete against, wouldn't that be awesome? How do they compete against the North Faces and the others? The North Faces massive.
Eddie Bauer is a little bit more older gen and a little bit more traditional gen, but that's okay. It's all good. So you came as a model to South Africa to get your Eddie Bauer on. And you stayed.
To get my Eddie, can I stay? But there was no Eddie Bauer in South Africa. So where it was Montgomery Ward's working in Chicago and Sears as well at that time.
Okay.
And Macy's. But Eddie Bauer, as I said, was the biggest client coming over to South Africa. It was clients like Woolworths, not the Woolworths Cafe or coffee shop that you have in the States. We have a Woolworths that's a full-fledged retailer that does food and clothing.
Okay.
Truerts, Edgar's, and other brands here in South Africa, and met the love of my life. And look, the country is beautiful. Don't get me wrong. It's a beautiful, beautiful country. I recommend that you come and visit. I know you know the likes of Cape Town, but there's also so much more to see in terms of Soweto and getting to understand the history of the country, a young democracy, vibrant country, 60 million people, very, very diverse, and just a topography as diverse as the States in a much smaller geographical space. So you can see more in you know, a less amount of time.
I will be there in a post-pandemic world, my friend. I will be there, knocking at your door.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Me,
so, you know, after about 4 or 5 years, and, you know, with the, you know, my first marriage, you know, transitioning and ending, and then slowly making the decision to move to South Africa. Children were, you know, a key component because while I had my first daughter in the States, I also had my first son in South Africa. So that goes with that charming and naughtiness and madness that I don't wish on anybody. And that's also, you know, that's for my sins. You know, I had to make a decision. I couldn't be a father on two continents.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, I don't know how bad I wanted to at the time when I look back at it. I think as a grown man now, I probably could do it. But man, at 30 years old, I just was not ready. I wasn't ready, I think, for one family. And then, you know, to try to, you know, to be a father on two continents was just challenging, not just financially, but psychologically.
Yeah.
And for the mothers as well. So moving to South Africa then at a time post 1994 was just, it was pioneering new territory. I mean, it was, you know, the early era of Nelson Mandela and the new democracy and the whole bit and, you know, new wife and a new opportunity, you know, opportunity to get it right. And still didn't get it right in the beginning. I mean, it was almost easier with the wife, but with the children, that's where my challenge was. Just because, you know, you're operating in dollars in the States, you're operating in rands in South Africa, and it's quite a difference. And at the end of the day, it did pay dividends once I got this right to be able to manage finances in the States, as well as to be able to look after, you know, what I had in South Africa. And we still continue. It's not over. But I'm so grateful that you know, in establishing a family in South Africa, I have found not only happiness, which is the external, but I also found joy within because of what I've learned. So I get up with a new opportunity every day to be better, and that's what I think I'd love to share that with other folks, to say that, you know, don't judge your past and put yourself down and condemn yourself. Recognize that they're lessons. And you still have to work through them. You take them to your grave, fair enough. Yeah. And people will try to, you know, bring you down and say, yeah, you remember what you did. Remember what you did. You know, I look at it as, well, I can't change that. There are many things I still would like to try to do, as I talked about, in terms of reconciling with my daughter. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is that I put my mask on first. And I'm not talking about that COVID face mask, but that mask that that flight attendant talks about that drops from the ceiling. Put yours on first, and then if you are together, then you can start looking after other people. So
yeah.
I attest to the fact that that works, to make sure that self is looked after, not from an arrogance, but from a peace standpoint.
Yeah, well, that couldn't be more poignant now than ever, right? I mean, we're in this moment where people are really struggling. Isn't even really the right word, is it? I mean, I would say suffering, and a lot of that is emotional. You know, obviously there's physical suffering and financial suffering, and there's a lot of things going on politically that are causing suffering, but the emotional suffering that is going on is just, it's just beyond comprehension, really, because it's global and it's all of humanity at one moment experiencing something that, you know, is hard to comprehend. There's so much unknown. And you and I are both from an endurance sports world. That's where we met and became friends. You play in that world professionally as well. What does that look like for you? How'd you get into endurance sports? And tell me what you think in terms of the endurance sports mindset, how you use that in your everyday life.
Well, first, I can share with your audience where I got involved in terms of what type of endurance sport, and that's obstacle course racing, you know, as you know it as OCR. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And for those who don't know, I mean, it's simply natural and man-made obstacles that are created on a course for people to test their endurance, their strength, their speed, and agility, and even teamwork and camaraderie.
Yeah.
And a gentleman in Pretoria, just an hour north of Johannesburg, came up with the idea. He called it a warrior race, took it from the concept that was started, restarted, if you will, from Spartan and from Tough Mudder. The originators are arguably Colonel Mouse from the UK with his military obstacle course racing. But nonetheless, in that period of 2009 to 2010, and by the way, we also had IMPY. We had the IMPY Challenge in Cape Town, which is also an obstacle course race, which was from 2008. So in that period, just before 2010, there was IMPY Challenge, Spartan Race, Tough Mudder, and obviously Colonel Mouse that had built these obstacle course races that people would pay for the pain, and have this recreation. partly because we're living in peaceful time. So, you know, because it's peacetime, you know, we're not wearing, you know, these, you know, 10 kilo packs or 50 kilo packs and running through bushes and carrying ammo and enjoying the camaraderie that comes with it and the pain that comes with it. So we had to pay for it. We had to pay for it, make it an event. I think your triathletes, your cyclists, swimmers, and certainly your runners wanted to try something different, try something that could give them, you know, a unique challenge. And it took off. It took off like wildfire. I was brought in as an MC. The gentleman who started it, Peter Swart, saw me at a cycling race. There you go. At a cycling race that was a three-stage cycle race, also near Pretoria. And he said, I got an idea and you'd be perfect for it. And I think he was listening to a lot of motivational speakers on YouTube. He heard the accent, he heard the energy, the power, the credibility and the genuineness, which has become very important for me and my brand after having a lot of superfluous, you know, disingenuous relationships and behavior from my part. Man, to talk about authenticity and genuineness was exactly where I wanted to be. And so to send off 8,000 warriors on a weekend from a place of a genuine loving spirit that wanted to see people finish because they showed up. That's what it was all about. That's where I coined the name Warrior Rick. And 9 years later, I'm still not only the MC, but the chief inspirer to get people to do things they otherwise wouldn't do. Although they pay for it, sometimes other people pay for them to show up and to do these amazing feats of human kindness is what it is. Because, you know, really, to get through it, you can't do it alone. Whether it's me, you know, giving them an inspirational message or whether it's a stranger getting them up over a wall, it's really about what we call in Africa, Ubuntu. I am because we are. Yeah. And it's a way to get through it. So that's the endurance sport that I've been part of and still am part of. And it's spun off into many other, you know, areas in cycling, road racing. I also announced for the Comrades Race, which is the ultimate human race, we call it, 90 kilometers.
I need to get
running
there.
From, oh yeah, yeah, you're gonna love that.
I need to do
that. No, you're gonna love that, bro. The Comrades Race is now celebrating its centenary. They had to do the centenary virtually for the second year in a row. It was virtual. But we had a gentleman in our neighborhood run 90 kilometers in our neighborhood, Samantha. His name is Vincent Barnes. And I thought, Vincent's his first name. I'm blanking on the surname. But Vincent ran locally here and we followed him all around the neighborhood, weaving through the neighborhood, 90 kilometers. Took him 12 hours. He did it within the cutoff of 12 hours, right to his house. And it was amazing. His wife was there to greet him and it was brilliant. But all of these endurance sort of sport have really shown me the mental toughness that's required.
Exactly.
In preparation, during, even after, in terms of, you know, the post-trauma that you go through in terms of physical pain and emotional pain. And it's shown me that this is life. And this is why I, you know, we can admire soldiers, you know, who've gone to war. I'm not an advocate of war, but the camaraderie and the preparation, the strategic, you know, aspects that you have to go through is all mental toughness and mental wellness. So endurance for me has gone well beyond what is the physical, but in what I've had to do to also almost show myself approved that if I tell you that you can do it, I have to do it. I've got 5 marathons, 2 ultras, you know, to my name. And that's because of the fact that I was motivated by people I was motivating.
That's right.
Endurance, it's infectious. It's just an Absolutely. Infectious thing that says, if you can do 1K, you can do 2. If you can do 2K, you can do 4. And as you get going, you realize, wow. And you have to be careful because it can be addictive as well. We don't mind infections when it comes to sport, but the addiction you have to be careful of and make sure you manage your endurance because it's about consistency and not about intensity. But I've loved it. I've loved the opportunity to be across a myriad of sports, starting with OCR, mainly with road running, but to be able to be out there with like-minded warriors on a mission to just simply finish. Forget about first place. Just to finish, what a feat and what a, you know, what an honor to be part of that fraternity and sorority.
Well, being in that environment and being not only experiencing it as an athlete yourself, but being one of the ones who helps make the event happen and host the event, you know, create the experience for the people who are at it. What are some of the lessons that you witnessed or you experienced yourself?
I think the biggest thing is to surrender yourself to the elements that are around you. I think all too often we become arrogant because some even doing it for the first time. I've seen arrogance in big rugby buffs, for example, and weightlifters who come and do a warrior race. And you can see the arrogance, and then you can see they're not enjoying it. They're just trying to show that because they've mastered a sport or because they're good at something, that they're just going to overcome challenges by showing up and doing it alone. And it's the wrong attitude. It's that, you know, that you know, I always talk about the fact that if you want to do anything in life, you can be between confident and arrogant, but never let the needle sweep over to arrogant, because that's when the universe will smack you in the face. So you've got to allow and surrender yourself to the challenges. Don't try to overcome them by beating them over the head. Sometimes that's what I love about obstacle course racing. It takes a strategic mind, not just a physical and brawn mind.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's the first thing, is to allow the elements of rain, the elements of mud, the elements of height and depth to be able to be your friend, not to be your enemy. You don't have to force yourself through it, but to weave your way through it. The best way to learn how to manage anything when it comes to sport is to watch children playing. Whether they're playing on a jungle gym, whether they're running a sprint race, watch, look at their faces, look at their attitude, look at how they behave. And I'm talking about preschool children. They just have this beautiful innocence that we need to use when we participate. Allow your mind to be free. We've talked about it before, Samantha, in terms of music, in terms of song, something that gets, you know, stuck in your head. Why? Because you don't want to be so focused on the obstacle, whether it be a long race or whether it be an obstacle course race or swimming, whatever it is. You don't want to be so narrowed in on that you break. You want to be able to be fluid and flow. And the way you flow is to get in the zone. So I would say avoid arrogance in terms of anything you want to do from an endurance perspective. Remember consistency over intensity. That's for your preparation as well as during the race. It's rather do things in small beats. Graduate slowly. So graduating is about working gradually and winning, you know, from time to time, and learning. You might get a slip, but just take the steps gradually. Don't skip steps. Go through them, you know, one by one. Consistency over intensity, and don't be arrogant.
Those are not the lessons I thought you were going to say. So I love this. Now, the interesting thing is you talked quite a bit about kids in there and watching them play and that kind of stuff. I noticed you do a ton of work with youth in South Africa, and you do quite a bit of work with women's causes. Can you tell me what's behind those two passions for you?
Well, I mean, I can tell you where it started, and I won't be political, but the truth of the matter is that Donald Trump and Jacob Zuma, our local president, who was elected in 2008, and, you know, our president from America, ex-president, from 2016, that was the time I said, what can I do? What can I do to help change the world? What is my role in this? And that's when I went directly for the youth. I started knocking on doors at schools. Yeah. These schools didn't know me from a bar of soap. I just knocked on the door and just said, hey, I'd like to inspire and motivate your youth. And I think obviously there was some cachet in the accent. There was some cachet in my work that I'd done with the warrior race. And I had enough in my profile and my credentials to show my credibility. And I'll tell you what, hey, I got in quickly, I got in fast, and I endured many kilometers and many, many schools, 250 schools to be exact, over 2 years.
Wow.
From 2016 to 2018. I just took it upon myself to jump in the car and just start rolling. And just, whether it was a rural school, whether it was an urban school, peri-urban school, public, private, it didn't matter. Special needs schools, I said to myself, this is my opportunity to give. As we know, better to give than to receive. And I received tenfold, Sam. I started, I was able to practice my gift. What a beautiful thing. So I was able not only to share knowledge and express it from a point of reference in terms of wisdom and what I had learned and what it was to live in a patriarchal society and being patriarchal myself. I was able to share the lesson, share the learning, to talk about what accountability is in terms of leadership. And in doing that, I went off curriculum and I was on almost this amplified life orientation. I began to see what my role was there to do, and that was to support the teachers and the parents. Because while they were so narrowly focused on getting our children to pass, they just wanted them to pass, just keep passing them through. We were getting children that were so-called graduates who had no leadership skills.
Right.
And so I said, we cannot have more of these Donald Trumps and Jacob Zumas who are running after titles.
Yeah.
They were not leading. They wanted the seat and they wanted that power.
Yeah.
And they wanted the money and they weren't doing it in a way that was inclusive. And that's what got me excited. It gave me a lot of material. Right? I didn't have to search on YouTube and listen to other motivational speakers immediately. All I had to do was just turn on the news and say, well, that's what I'm not going to do. And it was very inspiring to be able to learn who I was and who I was not. So my brand, Warrior Rick, became very narrowly focused on leadership development in the youth. And that just spun into meeting brands and clients who wanted to support me. And one of them is Spar. You know, Spar is our local grocer who is one of the biggest in South Africa. They have an international footprint as well. And as of 3 years ago, they started a campaign around ending gender-based violence. And with that, I studied what gender-based violence is. I looked at where my role could have been in gender-based violence in my history and even to this day. And when I learned that gender-based violence goes beyond the physical, that it was psychological, emotional, and economic, I said, you know what? I'm also a perpetrator. I said, I can see how I have perpetrated violence. Although I've never laid a hand on a woman, I still was guilty of being a perpetrator. And I said, children need to know this, especially young boys. They need to understand that your words matter, that your words are a creative force, that your existence is based on you claiming what you want and speaking life for yourself and speaking life to others. And if you do the opposite, then you're damaging society. And so that's where the end of gender-based violence came in, with SPA, you know, powering it behind me. And now I go around the country, not only speaking to the youth about general themes around getting away from these weapons of mass distraction and focusing on the importance of leadership and making sure that you're accountable for your behavior. I'm also speaking to men, women, and children about ending the scourge of gender-based violence by respecting yourself first, putting your mask on first, and then recognizing the importance of respecting others, especially women.
Wow, I love this. Isn't it fascinating how your path has continued to evolve? And what's so beautiful is how open you've been to that, right? So you didn't have like a preconceived story of your life before it was even written. You live the life every day, every month, every year. You get up, you continue to live it consciously, and you take the path turns and twists and, you know, as they come your way, because they're opportunities, right? I mean, even if it's sucks, it's an opportunity for growth. So coming back to the endurance mindset and the mentality that you have around leadership and youth, here we are in this global pandemic still. And I want to know, how are you faring and how is your community faring?
Thank you for that, because I know that, you know, we can have these interviews and we can be very pedantic about these conversations. It's virtual. It's not easy. We're talking about tough subjects. But for you to ask the question, how are you doing, is so much more meaningful today than it would have been 2 years ago. So I want to say thank you for acknowledging the fact that it has not been easy. I was a victim of COVID, so I tested positive with my wife over a month ago. We have recovered, thankfully, from mild symptoms. We have recovered. I think probably less anxious now that we have been infected. But also, there's there's a real need to roll out the vaccination program faster. It is happening in South Africa. We are now 7 million vaccinated of a total of 60 million with a target of 45 million for herd immunity. So we're getting there. And it's no fault of the people necessarily in terms of vaccination hesitant or anti-vaxxers, but more because of the fact that we've had some challenges in our leadership in terms of rolling out the program. But we're there now. We have local manufacturing happening, as well as overseas producers of the vaccine, which I think are going to help. Also more knowledge and information, truth is prevailing in South Africa, which is good. And so we're getting the right information that we can make the right decision, or the honest information, right? Fair and open and honest information that allows you to use your critical mind to decide what you want to do. And it looks good. In terms of lack and loss, we've had it. We've lost people, family members. We've lost friends, not just to COVID, but to the strain on the health workers and the hospitalization. I think it's created a lot of anxiety. Nobody wants to go to the hospital. So even if you have underlying conditions, even if you don't die of COVID, and a lot of times you don't have preventative care. So I think that's been a huge problem in terms of even myself, that little aches or whatever, that I'm not a hypochondriac, but there are times where I would have gone into casualty just to check up or whatever, but I said, I'm not going to that hospital, no way. And it's not just about getting infected at the hospital, which is one of the things, but also it's that mindset of anxiety and of doubt and of fear that the closer you are to the hospital, the closer you might be to the morgue. And I think that's what's been our reality, you know, over these last 17 months. But by the grace of God, by our tenacity, our strength, by our pulling together, we are fortunate because we are a lot in the house and we have enough space to be able to get fresh air, to get our vitamin D, to exercise, to eat right, and to do the basics, right? Eating right, movement, not just exercise, movement, purposeful movement, and being able to get rest, to turn everything out. We've been able to help each other to do that. And that's been a big part for me, is the rest, recovering from a knee injury just before COVID, recovering from COVID, recovering from anxiety, recovering from another insurrection that now we've had. You had yours in the States, and then we have to copycat the States. These are all things I needed to retreat and to revitalize my mind in order to come back from. So how am I doing? I'm blessed and highly favored. I'm strong and mighty. I'm a joint heir to the throne. I have to remind myself every single day. So those three things that I told you in terms of rest and nutrition and exercise, the one that covers all three of those aspects in my day is prayer and meditation. And I do that in order to stay sane and to thrive instead of survive.
I love it. Let's talk about that little bit of darkness, the depression and the anxiety that people are feeling in this time. Of course, it is natural that people are having those feelings, and there's no judgment right or wrong. I mean, everybody has some level of it, some worse than others, obviously. But what are some tools, some really, you know, just basic tools that any person, every person can utilize at this time, whether it's depression or anxiety they might be battling with on a daily basis?
Remember, we talked about this at the top, and it's peace, right? You know, for me, if you want to get through anything, it's not about, you know, hitting things head on or just fighting through it, or even, you know, the other side, just, you know, escaping from it. Mm-hmm. To find peace, you need to settle. And you have to allow certain things to happen. There is chaos. There's also order.
Yeah.
But too much chaos is not good, and too much order is not good. We're seeing that in the world right now.
That's true.
So we've had both. Yeah. We've had some claim that there's too much order, and we've had some claim that there's too much chaos. Mm-hmm. But in your life and who you are, take what you have to deal with in your space and find the peace by finding the balance between chaos and order. Find the balance between challenges and celebrations, or happiness, you can call it. Because remember, happiness is not what you have inside. Happiness is the birthday present. Happiness is when my wife says she loves me, or we have a barbecue. You know what I mean? It's those Those are external things. So I'm not waiting for happiness. So anyone that's dealing with anything, understand that others are also dealing. They're also reeling. And there are some who are doing just fine. And again, back to arrogance, are nonchalant about what you might be going through. And might say, just get over it. Just get over it.
Yeah.
And you know, don't cry. What are you talking about? This is a feeling I have. If I feel disappointed, you can't judge my disappointment. You can't judge me if I'm depressed. You can't judge me if I have something that I'm dealing with. What you can use is empathy. So you want to talk about tools. The tools start with having an empathetic heart. That means I understand. Don't give me sympathy. Don't talk about me being dead while I'm still alive. Let's try empathy. So what I need to do for myself is I need to be self-empathetic and say, I understand that I might be going through chaos, or I might be going through people trying to control me. But I, in that understanding, I'm gonna try to seek the balance. I'm gonna try to get in between that. I know that I should welcome challenges because therein lies my opportunity. Yep. That's the only way I can get success, is that I need to welcome the challenge, but I don't have to have an overwhelming challenge.
Yeah.
It's a small challenge, like getting up in the morning early. That's a challenge enough.
Yeah.
But what do I do? What do? I set up what the reward is. Remember I said celebration? Celebrate what the reward is. Boom. There you go. So you say, okay, I'm going to get up earlier than before, but I'm going to pour my favorite coffee. So you get the challenge and reward balance right. Because even, and this is where we have this problem with depression, with substance abuse, because what happens is that you tilt that happiness into overt pleasure. And when you have this extreme overt pleasure through substance abuse or through, you know, lying on the beach for you know, 4 weeks, you get where I'm going here, is that you haven't balanced challenges with, you know, this pleasure. And that's why, you know, pleasure, you know, we talk about it in terms of having the pursuit of happiness, right? You know that. It's in the Constitution. Why should we be going after the pursuit of happiness is doing what they did even before America was colonized. It shouldn't be about the pursuit of happiness. That's external. We should be in the pursuit of peace. The pursuit of peace is where you can be strong. You can still be mighty. You can still go through challenges. You can still deal with COVID. You can still deal with lockdown, lack and loss, because you got balance. If you are overtly happy, if you are going through extreme pleasures, you can't deal with tragedy. You can't deal with substance abuse if you are overtly and extremely going through an extreme pleasure. That's euphoric. Euphoria doesn't give you balance.
Yeah.
Peace does.
It should also be about the cultivation of joy, which is something you have to cultivate in your own garden. Nobody Thank plants you. The garden for you. And it's not something that grows all by itself. It needs to be planted and tended to and nurtured and all of that. And that's daily work. That's daily work. I think a lot of people might see people like us out in the world at this moment with maybe a different perspective or a different experience and not be able to understand, just think that, you know, we must have it made. We're just living, you know, fat and happy somewhere. That's not at all the case. We're everyday humans, just like everybody else. And we have our struggles, but we have just a different set of tools, I guess. And really that's why we're here, right? On this planet, you and I, is to help others, you know, find their
cultivate joy so that you can share the joy. That can make
the harvest.
Somebody happy.
Because there's the harvest.
Yeah. Share the harvest, 100%. So cultivate the joy, share the harvest. Then we can talk about the happiness, because the happiness doesn't come. For me, the happiness can't just be mine.
No.
There's a giving and a receiving. So the reason I'm happy now on this call is because you're on it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be happy if I was doing a selfie video. I would be cultivating the joy and hoping that there was a harvest. So I understand, again, back to Ubuntu, I am because we are, but also, and I've shared this with my local African brothers and sisters, because it is an African proverb, it's not just one way. We are because I am. So we are coexisting. Mm-hmm. And that's where the beauty is in terms of life. So anyone that's going through any sort of depression, sadness, disappointment, frustration, Find peace, cultivate joy, be empathetic with yourself and be empathetic with others. Even those who may not understand, be empathetic with them and understand that time will heal, that you won't necessarily feel better today, but that when you put your head on that pillow, that consciousness, oh my goodness, that consciousness of your self, being self-aware of who you are and who you are in this time, I think will bring a better morning, so that at least when you try with failure, but try some more and with failure again, because that's the process, you'll win, you'll get to graduate, you'll have some successes. And we need to celebrate whatever successes we get out of that depression, out of that sadness, out of that disappointment, because even just a little bit of light, just a little bit of joy can take out a very dark day.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot to be said in this moment about connecting to other humans. And I mean, really connecting to other humans, right? I don't mean playing an online video game with, you know, 10 strangers or being on social media. I mean, having a connective moment, conversation, eye contact, even if you can't make physical contact, there's plenty of room for conversation right now. People have a lot of time on their hands. So making a connection with other humans is just, that's honestly been my superpower. I will say during this pandemic, that has been my superpower, is I found myself retreating in the first couple months just out of confusion and misunderstanding and not really grasping the reality of the situation. And of course, being in denial to a certain extent. And so for me, I had to really make an effort, and now it comes naturally, and it's the biggest part of my joy cultivation, is finding those little moments to connect with humans in whatever capacity that is. Perfect strangers in a moment of exchange, that is incredibly powerful. You haven't talked to in a long time. I mean, it's just like gold, that people are not really going out, most people, and really utilizing that gift that is just sitting there. What do you have to say about that? How can we make that happen?
Oxytocin. Look it up. Oxytocin. This drug.
The nurture chemical.
This chemical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This thing that we've got in our bodies is activated when we give and when we receive.
Yeah.
So it's exactly what you're saying. So as you're cultivating joy when you're alone, right? You talk about being in your prayer corner or meditating or taking a walk, cultivate the joy, because that opportunity you have with a stranger.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Even when you do it with that smile, good morning. I tell people all the time, rather just greet, say good morning, because maybe you're just giving it to yourself. Maybe they won't respond. Don't get upset. Take that good morning and use it for you. That's your oxytocin. But my golly, if they come back to you and say, good morning. Oh, what it does. And people laugh at runners, because those runners are always like, morning, good afternoon. Hi, how's it?
And I have to wave at everybody. It's hilarious. And half the people don't acknowledge me, and I could care less.
They don't acknowledge.
I could care less.
But you're getting it.
Yeah.
You're getting the oxytocin. If they get it, great. But here's the beauty of it. And I learned this the other day. It's not just the one, two that are getting the oxytocin. There's a third party. The one that are in earshot, sight line of two people giving and receiving, picking up something that fell out of someone's bag, giving someone a five rand, waving and smiling. That interaction that the third party sees gets oxytocin as well.
There's a fourth part.
And what is the oxytocin? Oh, come on.
There's a fourth part. Because that mother, father, child, grandparent, teacher, boss, whatever, has the chemical in their brain, going through their body, through their blood system, stimulating their brain, and then they go to the world to do the thing, the next thing, to parent, to teach, to lead, whatever. And they're now carrying that forward into that experience. It has longevity.
It just spreads. It's a pea in a pond.
Yeah.
And the concentric circles, the more these peas we're throwing in a pond, not even a pebble, just a small little pea.
Yeah.
Right? It just needs to tap, just touch the water. If it just touches the water, it just And we can feel it from South Africa to Australia to the United States to Latin America. We can feel it. It just, what happens is it reverberates. Yes. And the same thing is with negativity. You can throw a negative pea in the pond as well. Yeah. And I told you so. I told you it wasn't going to work. I told you this is going to happen. Or you can say, as we're saying now in South Africa, spring's coming early, but we've had one of the coldest winters in the last 10 years. But we can keep talking about, hey, it's one of the coldest winters. Hey, I can't get up. I'm too tired. Can't get out of the blanket. But how about spring is coming early? How about that? Even while you're still experiencing a cold winter. Or how about the fact that there isn't a fourth wave, that there isn't another variant, or that you will get a job, or that you will be promoted? Throw your pee in the pond. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
What's the alternative? You decide that you're going to be negative, turn your back on the pond, and while everybody's enjoying a wonderful new spring, COVID is gone, you're living in your post-COVID world still in COVID.
Yep. That will happen, unfortunately, to some people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But not to anybody that we get in touch with. not having it.
No. Even the grumpy old man, I prod him, man. I still prod that grumpy old man, eh? He sees me coming from a mile away because I'm loud, eh? You can hear me. You can see my presence is big. And when I come in with my big good morning, he can grunt all he wants. But you know what? At some point in life, and it may not be me. It doesn't have to come from me. There are many peas in this pond.
Yep.
They will be able to touch him in a way that he's going to say, you know what? Let me try.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's my contribution.
Yeah. For some people, it just is, there'll be a tipping point, right? Where one day,
I think so.
Like one day, they will make eye contact. It could be the 20 times, you know, and then the head gets high enough to make eye contact. So yeah. I'm in quarantine for 14 days, as you know, in Australia. And, I'm not having human contact in this hotel room because that is how it rolls down, except for the fact I get phone calls from the front desk and phone calls from the people who do the food service. And there is a security guard in the hallway making sure nobody leaves their room. So there are some humans in the space. You know, my teammates are up in their room separate doing their thing. So throughout the day, we connect to each other and I make intentional connection to these perfect strangers who are sharing this experience with me right now. Right now, they are my world.
Correct,
Ming
correct.
In catering is my new best friend. He delivers, cooks food and delivers food to me three times a day. I can't think of a more important person in my world right now than a human
absolutely.
I have never met, ever. I may never meet Ming, but I have had conversations with Ming many, many times. So it's just,
oh my goodness.
It can be so simple, right? It can be something unexpected. It can be the smallest thing. When I do open my door here to put out trash or, you know, I can bring my food in, the security guard is sitting there. Of course, I open the door with my mask on. I can't leave the doorway. He's sitting down the hallway, but hello, how are you? You know, they change shifts and hey, good morning. You know, I mean, these people are also doing their job. They're also in need of love and support, just like me.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's so simple, right? It's so simple. But anyway, that's just a fun little side note. So let's bring our conversation to a close. This conversation, we'll have many, many more. But yes, indeed. In person, my friend, in person. South Africa, it's happening. Maybe
Woo-hoo!
It's comrades. What's the date of comrades? I might have to get that on the schedule.
June 2022. June 2022 would be the next one.
Okay. So it might have to be 23 then, because I got something.
Okay. That's all right. No.
Well, let's get that in pencil at least.
I love that.
So for you, my final question is, Ricardo, what does endurance mean to you?
What does endurance mean to me? Endurance means faith in what I cannot see, believing that what I'm doing in the present moment is going to make my future better.
Ooh, I love that. That's beautiful. Thank you so much, my friend. How can people find you? How can they follow you? How can they learn more about your journey?
I am Warrior Rick. And a good way to remember that is I'm the opposite of a worrier. So remove that O from worry, right? Go to war. Go to battle.
And Rick, R-I-C, not R-I-C-K.
Not R-I-C-K. Just Warrior Rick. Yeah. If you Google Warrior Rick, you'll find me. You can go to The Warrior Rick on Instagram, but all things Warrior Rick. I love to write articles on mental wellness. I love to help and engage people. So anyone that wants to chat, please DM me, send me an email, what have you. I'm open and ready to engage in what I can do. So I'll throw my pebble in the pond, and if they'll be willing to do that as well, we'll see if we can touch not only each other, but others, the third party and the fourth parties, so we can keep the oxytocin flowing.
I love it. Oxytocin flow. Okay, my friend, it's been a pleasure. I adore you, and I look forward to
it. I adore you as well. Oh, Sam. And just imagine when we meet in the physical. This has been a long virtual relationship. And I'll tell you what, watching you this morning, working out to Maniac, Michael Cimbello's song, Maniac, was just a thrill. And that's what's beautiful about our conversations. They're deep, they're intimate, but they're also a hell of a lot of fun.
That's how we roll, my friend. Okay, darling, you take care. I'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you for connecting with us for this episode of the Endurance Town USA Project. Discover more about today's guest, along with other great stories and video projects, by visiting us online at endurancetownusa.com. You can also follow us for updates and behind-the-scenes peeks at future episodes on Instagram at endurancetownusa. You can also connect with our creator, host, and life leadership and business coach, Samantha Pruitt, at samanthapruitt.com or on Instagram at thesamanthapruitt. And lastly, you can follow me, Travis Ford, producer and marketing creative, at rockharbormarketing.com or Instagram at rockharbormarketing. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time we go on an adventure to Endurance Town, USA. Bring it back.